Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. No one likes going to the doctor. Often it's hard to get an appointment, there's a long wait, you get very little time with a doctor whom you may never have met before, and then you might be referred out to one or a number of specialists, and then you have to deal with the insurance company. So it's no fun to be a patient. But it turns out it's no picnic for the doctor either. That's what cardiologist Sandeep Jahar discovered. His new book is called Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. It's a memoir of his own struggles with his chosen career, and it's also a diagnosis of the deep problems afflicting American medicine today. Dr. Jahar is the director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You say in your title that it's the disillusionment of an American physician. So I want to start by asking, what were your hopes and aspirations as a doctor?
Well, they were similar to what a lot of college students think about when they think about going into medicine, about going and helping people and being intellectually stimulated. You know, a lot of us have parents who grew up in a generation where doctors were held in very, very high esteem. They were in an exalted position in American society. My mother often said that she wanted us to become doctors so that people would stand when we walked into a room. And so, you know, we have a lot of those expectations. And I would say that the process of training largely insulates us from the realities of medicine. And so when I started as a, you know, an attending cardiologist, sort of the my final job, it was an eye-opener.
Well, and your previous book, of course, Intern, looked at that first year of medical school and that training that you went through. And I also wanted to ask you, I mean, you mentioned family. Your grandfather was a physician as well, right?
That's right. He was a physician in India. And I remember I used to go and watch him take care of patients. And, you know, he had a very important place in his community. And I remember he would provide charity care if patients couldn't pay. And he was, you know, more than adequately compensated for the care when patients could. And that sort of picture was largely the American picture in what some people call the golden age of medicine in the 1950s and 60s when, you know, first of all, life expectancy increased dramatically from right after World War II to the early 1970s. And that was largely due to medical advances, polio vaccination, coronary bypass surgery, heart transplants. I mean, there was a lot of just incredible advances, and people view doctors in a very different light than they do today. Doctors were, one rung below astronauts or Supreme Court justices in their importance, and they were largely, I feel, content with playing that important role in their communities. There was a lot of professional satisfaction, which is largely missing today.
So you went through about a decade of post-collegiate training, and then a decade ago, you finally emerged from your training and became an attending physician. When and how did the disillusionment begin?
Well, just a small correction. I after high school, I was in school or training for 19 years. So college, graduate school, medical school, internship, residency, fellowship. So that was actually 19 years. So
wow.
I was very ready to, get my first real job. And the picture that I found was that doctors were very demoralized. There was there were a lot of stresses in everyday practice, and a lot of them we know about, you know, calling for pre-authorization, filling out reams of paperwork. You know, I'm aware. I've read that doctors' office staffs spend up to 7 hours a day dealing with the paperwork of, you know, third-party insurers. So there was a lot of that. But I found that the biggest force that was disillusioning my colleagues was the sort of pervading commercial consciousness in medicine today, that we were being forced to act like business people and not as caregivers. And most of us went into medicine to take care of people, to develop relationships with people, and most of us didn't have a strong interest in the financial aspects of it and managing a business. And it's very hard to survive as a doctor today, especially in private practice, if you don't have that inclination. And most of my colleagues, I think, find that very troubling.
Listeners, we want to hear from you, particularly doctors. Do you share Dr. Jahar's disillusionment? And how are these modern forces of medicine playing out in your work? And of course, for patients, what's been your experience? Have you seen doctors who seem disillusioned and overworked and overwhelmed or the like? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. It's 212-433-9692. You mentioned this push for business push, push to make money. And of course, I think one can understand perhaps in private practice how that would play out because you're responsible for keeping that practice going and also making a living. But you, of course, work at an academic hospital. How does it play out there as an employee of a larger institution where you don't necessarily have to be worrying about your own overhead?
You know, I'd say fortunately, I'm largely insulated from some of those concerns. But you know, I mean, hospitals have to survive too. I mean, so, you know, I think all doctors have to have an eye on the bottom line. And, you know, even in academic practice, you know, we're judged on how many relative value units, which is like the currency of medical reimbursement, how many of those that we generate every year. You know, maybe not as directly as if we were in private practice, but it's still very, very important.
Well, relatively early on in your career, you ended up, in addition to your academic practice, you found yourself working at a private practice in order to pay the bills, essentially. Tell us about that.
Well, that's sort of the crux of the book is, you know, I came into my academic practice. I chose an academic practice, a teaching hospital, because of some of the, you know, academic ideals I had in my training. And what I found shortly after I started my practice, we had our son. My wife and I had our first child. And I found that, with the expenses of starting a family and paying back loans, that things were very, very tight. And so I had to start doing moonlighting work, which actually a lot of academic physicians do. And so I started moonlighting for a private cardiologist in Queens. And that was an incredibly eye-opening experience because I saw how medicine in some parts of this country are really practiced.
And how was that? Tell us about how it was practiced there.
Well, I mean, it was horrible. There was, there was just a huge assembly of patients who were waiting for various procedures, many of which were unnecessary, stress tests and echoes, and even though, you know, I wasn't ordering those procedures, I was overseeing the actual doing of the procedures. So it was very disheartening, and I found myself just feeling very dirty about it.
Well, and the physician who ran that practice told you, right, that the extra tests were being ordered or people were being held longer than they needed to be because but he needed to make money or wanted to make money.
Well, you know, there were various rationalizations. It wasn't as probably as direct as that, but he did at one point say, you know, I tried to practice ethical medicine, but it didn't pay. And he specifically mentioned that sometimes patients want the procedure. And if they come, a patient comes in with, you know, chest pain that's clearly, you know, a rib problem or, you know, something that's fairly benign, doesn't have to do with their heart, and you tell them you'll be fine, just take some Motrin, that he would claim, go down the street and go to a different cardiologist who would do the echo and the EKG monitor and the stress test. So so he said that, you know, he felt, and I'm aware that it was a rationalization, but he felt that a lot of what his conduct was being driven by what patients wanted, and you know, and he would blame the internet, and you know, and the little knowledge that sometimes patients come in with, but there's no question in my mind that a lot of it was because the fee-for-service system in this country creates a moral hazard among patients and physicians too to do procedures, to do tests, and doctors today are largely rewarded on the volume of service they provide, and that has to change.
And that means that expensive tests and procedures are much better reimbursed than office visits where you might talk to patients. I want to take a call from Sandy on the Upper West Side. Sandy, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I'm just going to take it forward a bit because the thing about the tests and procedures that are not required, we've talked about that, and people know that happens, and doctors also refer colleagues that are, you know, their friends or what have you. But in addition to all that, you have doctors now that are overwhelmed. You see in the waiting room 20, 30 people. They're all on the same health care plan. They're designated to a particular doctor in their zip code or area that's convenient. So it's a double-edged sword. You have the doctor that's overwhelmed with a waiting room full of people, and all he can think to do is get him in, get him out. He has to do it that way. Then you have a waiting room full of people. The majority of people, sadly, are very intimidated by the word doctor. And you have to sit down with your doctor, which is what I did, and say, look, I'm not a number. I live alone. I'm a person. You have to look me in the eye. You have to have some rapport with me, some level of care, or I'm not comfortable coming here. And once you do that, then the doctor is going to think, they don't want to lose patients either. But it's not totally their fault. They're looking at 20, 30 people in a room, and in their mind they're like, how do I get all this done and get out of here to play golf or whatever they have to do? So basically they can't stop long enough to sit down with you and say, how are you, where do you live? They know nothing about you. They know you have a blood test, a result, and it's get them in, get them out. I'm not blaming them totally, but the patient has to also say, look, maybe this is not the right doctor. Maybe you're not the right doctor for me. I need someone to listen. Or don't be intimidated by them. They're just someone that went to medical school. They're not God.
Sandy, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And Dr. Jahar, it sounds to me from what you've written and what you've said that that in many cases, if you had a patient say those things to you, your feeling might be, I would love to do that, but I feel like I can't.
Well, I agree with virtually everything that Sandy said, except for the golf part. That is from a different era, believe me. That's not the picture in practice today, for the most part. What I would say is I agree that because of various forces, including and I think especially decreased reimbursement, physicians have to see more and more patients. And if you have 8 to 10 minutes with a patient and they come in with, let's say, lower back pain, very, very common complaint, you can spend, you know, 20 minutes getting a good history, examining them, and then deciding that this lower back pain is totally benign. But when you're on a treadmill and the next patient's waiting and you have your office assistants calling you and saying, you know, hurry up, and I have personal experience with this and I have experience with my colleagues also experience this, then you're more apt to send them to an orthopedic surgeon or just to order an MRI and make sure that you're not missing something because you're on this treadmill. And the, you know, defensive medicine and fear of malpractice lawsuits is a big issue in doctors' minds.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show here on WNYC. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, and we're talking to Dr. Sandeep Jahar. His book is Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. And I want to hear the voices now of a few physicians who were calling in to just give us their perspective. Michelle in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to thank you for taking my call and congratulate Dr. Jahar on his book. I am an anesthesiologist in private practice. I practice out in a hospital in Queens, although I live in Manhattan. And my sense is that, you know, this is a bit of a world of our own making. You know, when I was a child, we went to the doctor, we got a throat culture, we got a pill, maybe a shot. The bill was sent off to my father's employer, never heard about it again. Now I live in a world where treatments can cost $50,000, $100,000. And if we hadn't, not we personally, but the medical industrial complex, if we hadn't created this world, if we had to rely on people paying out of pocket for a $50,000 procedure, there just wouldn't be anything like that. So this is a bit of a world of our own making.
Michelle, thank you so much for your call. I want to hear from Dr. Robert Murphy calling from Freehold, New Jersey. Dr. Murphy, I understand that you were in private practice for a long time, but you couldn't take the expenses.
Yes, I was in Plattsburgh, New York, which I'm a plastic surgeon, but I was the only board-certified plastic surgeon from Albany up to Montreal. And it was an idyllic situation. I mean, it was a relatively small town, and I took care of everybody. But it was my practice, and I could run it the way I wanted to. And a lot of stuff I did for free just because I said, oh, screw it, you know, it's easier just to do it free than to bill for it. For Medicaid, it was worthless to bill for it, you know. So I took care of everybody, and I tried to run it. Patients would always say, God, nobody waits here. I've come in to see you, and you're early. Because, I don't know, I had trained at the VA for a time, and, you know, those clinics were just unbelievable. So I didn't want people to wait. I wanted to, you know, I knew everybody and had real good rapport, but malpractice insurance, wages, et cetera, just drove me to the point where, you know, I wasn't making any money, even though I was just working my tail off. So I joined the hospital as an employee, and they
to get out of private practice and into a hospital. You're saying?
Yeah. Well, the hospital, which I was right next to, just bought my practice, and they started kind of playing the RVU game. To which I wanted to say, "Man, do you think that I'm not working? I'll give you a blizzard of RVUs." But then they were, telling me, but you can't do anything for free. To which I kind of went, oh, well, okay. So,
Dr. Murphy, I'm going to have to jump in and thank you very much for your call. And, you know, it's clear that you're experiencing many of the same forces that Dr. Jahar is talking about. And Dr. Jahar, I want to throw this question to you from Antonio on our website. This is sort of the where do we go from here and what are the solutions question. Antonio says, does the doctor believe we should move to single payer? And is there a movement to be more personable and pay more attention and time to the patient in the field, kind of like the locavore movement in food production?
Well, I know that the dominant incentive scheme in medicine today is financial, and that has just created a lot of misery. So we have to change that scheme, and single payer is definitely should be on the table. But if we don't go to a single payer system, and it's hard to do that today. I mean, the political obstacles are just too great. I think that even within the system that we have, we can create new incentives schemes to reward for excellence in clinical care, for example, or to reward doctors for better patient satisfaction. You know, it's hard to see right now exactly how it's going to evolve, but it's so important. I did want to say one other thing about what Michelle said. It is true that I think some of what the mess we're in was created by doctors. You know, after Medicare was created in 1965, doctors' salaries went they skyrocketed. You know, if you look at the average salary of a doctor in 1940, it was in inflation adjusted dollars $50,000. In 1970, about 5 years after Medicare, it was $250,000. And that's because I think Medicare created a lot of moral hazard in the profession. And there was nothing holding doctors back from ordering tests, ordering consultations. And it just became a big mess. And that's why managed care was created, to help us deal with that mess. So I think that in some ways today we're paying for the sins of our forefathers in medicine.
And, of course, now with the advent of the Affordable Care Act, lots of changes happening, probably many more to come. Dr. Sandeep Jahar's book is Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. He's the director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Dr. Jahar, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Up next, we'll follow up on yesterday's conversation on changing sexual assault policies on college campuses. We'll hear from an administrator who had a hand in writing the new policy at Columbia. That's coming up next.